Buddha's idea is that, you know, we have this consciousness, the part of us that makes us the person that we are, as opposed to the eyelashes and the nose and the feet, right? There's the body part of us, and we've got the consciousness or mind. These, you know, Buddhism uses these words to mean the same thing: consciousness, mind. So the mind part of us, the conscious part of us, is the person, if you like. Of course, the body is obviously plays a big role. You know, we do the shooting with the body, we do the hugging with the body. The body clearly is incredibly important. But if you think about it, you know, although we tend to really identify ourselves as our body so strongly, because it's what we see and touch and feel every day, isn't it? But we know perfectly well, you know, the eyelashes don't make decisions, and our fat belly doesn't get depressed. You know, it's not that. It's not your. You know, even your physical human heart or your hand that feels love. This is very clear if we analyze. It's the conscious part of us. In Buddhist terms, that's the person. You know, all your feelings and emotions and thoughts and concepts and ideas and all of this. That's your mind in Buddhism. Not just your. It's not your brain. It's not just your thoughts. It's a very different use of the word. It refers to the whole being, all the part of you that's not your body. In a very simple way of saying it. So this consciousness. You know, the radical difference, I think, between Buddhist view of what we are and where we come from is this one. That, you know, the consciousness, when we began at life, at the beginning of life, you know, when the egg and sperm come together, and you know, what normally, if we're ordinary materialist view, we would say that's when I began, you know. And then if you're a Christian, or for example, you would say at that point God perhaps puts the soul into you and the person is there. You know, God created you, the real you, right? Well, Buddhism has neither of those views, you know. There is, of course, the egg and sperm. It's very obvious. This egg and sperm comes together, the egg from the mother and the sperm from the father. But in Buddhist terms, what causes them to come together and stay together is not God or some superior being. And I'm not criticizing that view, but it's just not the Buddhist view, you know. Putting something there, creating something, that the you that turns in, you know, the part that what goes into that egg and sperm that causes it to continue to stay together and turn into the fetus, right? As opposed to all the other egg and sperms which go down the toilet, or whatever happens to them. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, just normal, ordinary, you know? Then what causes them to stay together is the entry into them of the continuity, if you like. Well, I'll describe this, because this is a crucial point of the wheel of life, you know? The continuity of a part of your consciousness. In other words, if you're sitting here in this chair at this moment labeled Fred, you know, whatever, you know, the conscious part of you, if you had the clear memory to trace back each moment of this life without losing a single second, which we can clearly see most of us can't do. We remember fleeting moments of our lives, don't we, you know? So if we were able to trace back a consciousness right back to the, you know, coming out of the womb, then before that, the 9 months in the mother's womb, when there was a kicking, living little being in there growing and developing. You, in other words, Fred growing, okay? Well, you get right back to the very first moment of the egg and sperm. We'd all agree, wouldn't we, whether we think Christian or whatever, that that's usually the beginning of the person. Well, maybe people have a different view, but the Buddhist view is this. If you traced your consciousness right back, you'd get back to that moment. So then the key question is, isn't it, what was the moment before? Where was I, if you like, the moment before? Well, Christian view, you came from God. Western materialist view, you didn't exist before. You are the body, and that's it, babe, you know? And then the Buddhist view is that a subtler level of this consciousness, and I'll describe this now, is coming from a previous moment of its existence. In other words, your consciousness, in Buddhist terms, if you can trace it back from now to the conception, you can keep tracing it back. There's a continuity, an unbroken continuity of your conscious energy. In just the same way, you think about it, there's a continuity of anything. You know, if you trace back the body of Rabina from this moment right back, where did it come from? Excuse me, my mother's egg, my father's sperm. Where did they come from? Their bodies. Where did they come from? Their mother's egg, their father's sperm. And so you can trace back the continuity of physical energy. You can trace back the continuity of this bead, their bone, apparently, right? So that came from some animal. So you can trace that back. You understand? Everything, piece of paper, you trace it back to a tree, which goes back to a previous tree. Everything has got a continuity of its own particular energy. So in Buddhist terms, consciousness or mind, and there are many very profound teachings on this, you know, really to go deeply into, to think about and meditate on. Consciousness is non-physical. It's not something physical. It doesn't have the characteristic of a brain or nervous or system or anything like this, you know. It's not physical. Consciousness is non-physical energy. Now, the Christian view would say that the soul is that. right? In Buddhist terms, it's all of you, if you like. All your consciousness, your thoughts, your characteristics, your personality, in other words. And that doesn't come from your mother and father. Because in Buddhist terms, that doesn't come from the egg and sperm. That's not found in the genes. You can see tendencies. You can see, you know, we can really, there's no contradiction, you know. The Buddhist term, Buddhist view, there's no contradiction between saying that your body came from your father and mother and that you can see physical characteristics and tendencies and things like that. That's not a contradiction. I mean, there's no time to go deeply into all of this stuff now, but it's all there in the Buddhist teachings, you know, Buddhist philosophy. But basically, consciousness, the person, comes from a previous moment of this continuity of consciousness in the same way you have the continuity between now and conception. So you just keep tracing it back. So the Buddhist view is this continuity of consciousness, right, is uniquely one's own. It didn't come from somebody else. It wasn't created by some person, mother, father, or anybody else, or a superior being. It's not a created thing. It's created in the sense it's moving, it's changing from moment to moment. But in the same sense that this mala, you know, is not, it is created, but not out of like a puff of smoke. Do you understand? Like, boom, there's nothing, boom, there's a mala. Not like that. We know there's a logical cause and effect continuity, isn't there? Well, that's exactly the Buddhist view. It's a logical cause and effect continuity. So given that one can look into how the mind is non-physical. Now this is a crucial point in Buddhism, because the whole of Buddhist picture of this thing of wheel of life, the whole Buddhist philosophy of karma, you know, which is Buddha's view of describing how come we are what we are, how come reality is. It absolutely is the crux of it is this, that consciousness is non-physical, you know. So this continuity of consciousness. Now, we've got different levels of consciousness. It's really obvious, you know. We've got the waking, walking, talking, conceptual, sensory level of our reality, isn't it? Which is usually the person that we know that we are, right? Then we know, we all know experiences. We go to sleep. The body essentially becomes, you know, kind of quiet. The senses aren't functioning. The sensory level of our consciousness has temporarily ceased. The normal, ordinary, everyday kind of working, walking, talking, calculating, conceptual consciousness is certainly not working at sleep, is it? It's unconscious. Except for a certain period when we have this dream world, this totally interesting, everyone has different views about it, this level of our reality we call dreams. Now, obviously, it's your consciousness. In Buddhist terms, it's just it's another level of your consciousness. So according to the more esoteric teachings, which is really kind of tasty and appropriate here, we've got the gross level of consciousness, if you like, which is the function, the day-to-day functioning level. We've got the subtler level, and we do taste that occasionally. We touch upon it in dreams. But there is this subtler level. Now, I mean, we know there are so many people who have so many experiences of leaving their bodies in dreams and doing remarkable things and having kind of clairvoyant experiences of the future. All these things, you know, most of us in our culture, we take them for kind of like a grain of salt, you know. But in Buddhist terms, this is kind of interesting, because this subtler level of consciousness, because it's not gross and doesn't depend upon the existence of body and brain, right, then it has got more power. And what's interesting in Buddhist terms, this subtler level, and there are even subtler levels of our consciousness, and I'll talk about that, this level of our conscious being doesn't depend for its existence upon a brain, a nervous system, a body. And this is, you know, the way Buddhism describes, which is how come a person can leave their body, which we find in the West outrageous concept and kind of fascinating, but nobody understands it. We would say we don't know how to explain it, and scientists don't know how to explain it. Well, Buddhism has detailed explanations, you know. It's normal in Buddhism, no big deal. Because consciousness is non-physical in its nature, you know. Even the gross level, which depends for its existence and its functioning upon a decent brain. We can see. Your brain, you know, if your brain is messed up, well, everything comes out kind of crooked, doesn't it? But Buddhist terms, your consciousness, you, your thoughts, your feelings, they are not physical, you know. And that means your anger, your love, your kindness, your generosity, that's your mind, that's your consciousness. That's not physical. It functions as the gross level, as I'm saying, through the body, through the brain. But it isn't those things. So consciousness in general, in Buddhist terms, is non-physical. And as I said, a crucial point is it doesn't come from God or Buddha or some superior being. Or your parents, for that matter. Which is, you know, how it argues with those two major different views. It comes from previous moments, if you like, of you. Just that you, in a past life, were labelled another person, labelled another being, that's all. The you of you now, yes, is labelled Rabina. But Rabina, we all can agree, wasn't he, you know? Before the time when the egg and sperm came together. This is clear. But the consciousness continued from before. So this is a crucial point in this whole idea of all of Buddhist practice is centered on this idea. That the consciousness, your thoughts and feelings and emotions, your suffering, your happiness, your positive, your negative, whatever you want to call it, all of it is yours. It didn't come from someone else. So if you want to find a creator in Buddhism, You know, and it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but all the teachings on this are all there, you know, in Buddhism. You can be called the creator. Who made your own suffering? You, honey, sorry, you know. So all of Buddhist practice is based on this essential point. That, you know, and this is what the view of karma is. And this is where the whole idea of so-called the wheel of life, you know, the wheel of life. What this means in the most simple way is that, you know, if we look into our thoughts and feelings and emotions now, which is the starting point if you're attempting to practice, you know. So Buddhism talks about practice, and we usually have this idea of meditation. So meditation in Buddhism, this word, it means, it's in Tibet, the Tibetan word for it simply means, it means essentially becoming familiar, familiarizing yourself. So you can say in the broadest possible meaning of this word meditation, it doesn't just refer to what you're doing in this posture, you know, someone looking holy with their eyes closed, being mindful, which is our usual idea of what meditation is. Meditation has a much deeper, clearer, bigger meaning, you know. It's in general, if you're using your mind at whatever level to be familiar, to familiarize itself with, say, the various things that are called cause and effect and meaning of reality and love and kindness and all this stuff that we label spiritual, right? Then that's called meditation. So truly, this activity, each one of us sitting here at this moment, concentrating, each of us listening, including me, you know, words are coming out of my mouth, but I'm listening to this stuff, processing it. Same thing. Then each of us actually is meditating. You know, this is called meditation. Because we're familiarizing our minds with certain approaches to reality, you know. So meditation, you know, and of course there are other formal modes where you do it far more intensively, and they're very sophisticated in Buddhism. And what they're all about are they're the methods that you use to help help yourself, you know, to familiarize yourself first with, say, Buddha's view of reality, karma this and kindness and love and all the stuff that is called Buddhism, let's say. And then familiarizing yourself also with what's actually happening in your own mind. Because this is absolutely crucial. But Buddha's view, like I'm saying, is, you know, your mind is yours. Your suffering, therefore, what you experience, what you feel, what you say, what you do, you know, all your experiences, what happens to you, how people perceive you, how they treat you, whether you're happy, whether you're suffering, whatever, all of this essentially is coming from our mind, which we're going to talk about, because this is the whole idea of wheel of life, right? So, if this is true, we take that even as a given in the very beginning, then clearly we have to learn to really become familiar with this mind. We have to learn to know well how to use this mind, because it's this precious resource. You know, I mean, Buddhism is saying, ultimately, each being who exists, having a consciousness, necessarily possesses the potential to be fully awakened, enlightened. These words, Buddha. Fully awakened just means Buddha. It's a Sanskrit word, you know. But it's talking, it's this state, Buddhahood, awakening, enlightenment, which we sort of think of as some kind of like place in heaven, next life or something, you know, which is how we tend to think of spiritual. It's actually a psychological state, because we are talking in Buddhism always about mind or consciousness. It's a psychological state, indeed, a state that most of us can't even conceive of. We would certainly not in our ordinary Western view of reality, Western view of psychology, would never posit such possibilities. You know, of being absolutely beyond suffering, absolutely clairvoyant, omniscient, basically. Omniscience is one of the qualities of Buddhahood. And Buddhism is saying each one of us, having this mind or consciousness, necessarily possesses that potential, you know. And that means also, omniscience is one aspect of it. Fully developed consciousness, beyond which it can't be developed further. That also one of the qualities of an enlightened consciousness, you know, which is our potential, is absolute empathy with all living beings. Absolute love, compassion, these words that we all know, you know. The full development of those qualities. Just this too, for example, this. Now, in our ordinary Western terms, we would never even imagine, we would never conceive, we don't ever posit the concept, the idea that we can be utterly free of suffering, absolutely free of delusion and neurosis. No way. As long as we think we can keep it under reasonable control, then we're a reasonable human being, you know. Well, Buddha's idea is that's just ridiculous. You can pretty sure changing yourself. This consciousness is like, you know, the analogy of water. I always think such a simple one, but very tasty analogy. Water, we know, is simply that pure, clear stuff, isn't it? But we also know it's always polluted all the time, constantly polluted. But we also know that with enough clarity and intelligence, you can, by finding the understanding the nature of the pollution, you can then find the antidotes to remove it, to come to what? Pure, clear water. And we know that pure, clear water is never fundamentally, permanently tainted by the pollution, is it? The water nature is always there. Do you see my point? H2O-ness is always there. Well, that's a good analogy for our consciousness. Buddha's saying our true nature, the true nature of what is consciousness, its nature, its natural state, is pure, clear, perfect, awakened, infinitely compassionate, infinitely wise, infinitely loving. This is Buddha's fundamental point upon which everything is based. This is our natural state, Buddha's saying. So it doesn't sound, it's not something, this purity, it's not, you know, Christians, for example, I was brought up a Catholic, which I have great respect for, you know. I was taught that God is within me, God is in everyone. It's a saying a similar thing. But in Buddhism, it's a far more exactly precise. We are actually God. I mean, my mother was shocked when I told her that, you know. My dear Catholic mother. That's kind of arrogant, right? But this is not being arrogant. This is Buddhist view. This is Buddhist experience. This is Buddha's kind of presentation of his discovery of reality. That our own being itself is already, is perfect, is in its nature unpolluted. But at the moment, sorry, totally polluted. The pollution is there, no question. And the pollution is called suffering. The pollution is called, and then the causes of suffering, which are our neuroses. So the whole Buddhist idea of what practice is, on the basis of the fact that we have this infinite potential, sitting there waiting to be uncovered, just waiting there to be uncovered, you know, it's ours. And no one gave it to us. It didn't come from God or Buddha. It's not some freak accident. It's not like Mother Teresa in Buddha's terms just popped out of the sky, some holy being, you know, especially blessed. In Buddhist terms, she is the, you know, this is what I'm going to talk about now, the whole, she is the person who has already done a lot of the work of depolluting her consciousness. And she popped into this life in her new mother's womb, and because of her past work that she carried with her in her consciousness, she then was able to do effectively, effortlessly, what she did in this life to benefit others, to be compassionate, you know. This is the idea. That she's no accident, you know. So none of us is any accident. This is one of the things I was going to talk about. So, back to this consciousness. So this pure nature that we all possess. And so what the work of a spiritual path is, and certainly the Buddhist one, is the work of just of learning to hear how that is so, hear the qualities of what your potential really is, learning to know what does it mean, H2O, you know, then learning to discover the nature of the delusions, the pollution, and then the work is to remove the pollution. That's all. That's it. And to develop the qualities, to develop the H2O-ness to its full potential. That's the job of becoming a Buddha. That's the job of a Buddhist. So this is on-the-earth stuff, you know. This is all practical. It's to do with the mind. It's to do with who we are. Not some holy place called spiritual, which is separate from our life. But real life is here, and it kind of feels like spiritual contradicts it, you know. And we all have this vague idea that we've got to give up things that are delicious and nice to be able to be spiritual. It's not true. Okay? All Buddha's saying is, and this is an interesting point, Buddha is saying that one of the characteristics of this pure consciousness, of this person, this mind, you know, that is, when it's depolluted, is that it's ridiculously happy. Because happiness, or this word they use often in spiritual terms, bliss, you know, just means very, very happy, that's all. Bliss is the natural experience of this unpolluted consciousness. This is exactly what Buddha is saying, you know. So the whole idea, one aspect of the reason why a person would want to practice the spiritual path is because you know you want to be happy. It's something you check up, you know, every moment of your life. What is propelling you to do whatever you do, generally, isn't it? This is this constant wish for happiness, contentment, fulfillment. Sometimes it's simply just the relief of some stress, not even to forget about the positive aspect, actual pleasure. And that's like a kind of almost like too much to expect, isn't it? Do you understand? The pollution is so intense that just a little bit of a relief from it, please, would be nice. What Buddha's saying is when the pollution is gone completely, and we're going to discuss the qualities, what is that pollution in Buddhist terms, then in the nature of who you are, you will be so blissful, it's incomprehensible to us now. And this is said, again, to be a simple fact that Buddha is describing, not some holy thing that somehow comes from God, or you get it when you give up all the pleasures of life or something. It's just something natural, it's just something integrated, it's something innately in who you are. Bliss is the experience of this unpolluted mind, awakened mind, whatever you like, you know. So the natural progression of the depollution is, as you get more and more of the rubbish out of the way, you become more and more so-called happy, meaning an enormous sense of well-being. That's what it means. Just enormous sense of utter contentment, fulfillment, happiness, joy, all these things, right? This is just from your own side now. I'm not even mentioning how we affect other people. We're looking at our own side, you know. So one of the fundamental then reasons to want to do this is because you know it is natural to want to be happy. We know that all the choices we make in our life unnaturally to get what we want, to get the thing that we think will make us happy. Okay, we're going to look at whether it does. That's the point, to look at. But that's what drives us, isn't it? When you choose a meal, you don't immediately choose the meal you loathe most and say, oh, great, I'm going to have this disgusting food now. You don't understand, it's so obvious. We immediately choose what we think, what we like, you know. So, okay, then Buddha's point is, right, you know you want to be happy. Then he's also saying, in fact, it is your potential. It is your absolute nature. You can be happy. That is the natural state of who you are. So then the very valid question next is, well, how come I'm not? You know, am I? We all have to humbly admit we're not. We have to admit we don't have happiness all the time. We are suffering. We have it for a while. It seems to go. It's fleeting. We don't really understand what causes it. We try this, we try this, we try this. Our entire life, isn't it, is trying to find what the hell causes happiness. It's just simply being content, even. We don't seem to be able to find it. So that's what Buddhism says. Okay, sorry guys, you do want to be happy, you have the potential to be happy, but you, excuse me, you're using the wrong methods. Wake up, you know. So that's where the contemplation has to begin. That's where we have to start looking. Okay, then Buddha, so what he's stating, he states various things. Buddha presents his philosophy very clearly, but he's saying, don't just believe it. Now you start using it, checking it out for yourself to see if there's any validity there. That's our job. That's our part of it. He's done the work. He was an ordinary being. In Buddhist terms, he was an ordinary person, polluted and suffering, and through discovery, through this practice of the work, doing the depolluting, he became so-called enlightened. You know, these words, fully happy, blah, 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 all these things. And all he's saying is, it is our potential. So he presents his path. And then it's up to us to take it, to look at it, to check it out, to taste it, to experience it, and see if there's any truth in it. That's up to us. That's our part. So, this is where the work begins. He is saying, it's our natural state, we can be. Then he's saying, well, if you're not already reasonable to look, well, you have to check up what it is that's causing you not to be happy, or what it is that's causing you the opposite, which is called suffering. And this is the whole thing. So this is exactly now the crux of Buddha's teachings, right? So we've discussed what the mind is, you know, just briefly, that it isn't physical, it doesn't come from God or Buddha, doesn't come from mother and father, so you can't blame them, you know? It's yours. It's ours, you know. If it's there, if you have it, it's yours. No one put it there for you. It's yours. Who created it? Well, you must have. So now let's look at that. That's the point. So this is where we start to look at how, what is suffering? What is the nature of suffering, right? How is suffering? What is it? And then, indeed, absolutely, what causes it? So there's this presentation of Buddha's teachings called the Four Noble Truths, you know. And again, it all sounds very holy with these capital letters and nobles and all this stuff. And we sort of do really separate religion so completely from our lives. But in Buddhist terms, it's simply a philosophy that's presenting life. It's not a there is nothing separate from life. It's not a possibility to separate it from life, you know. So these Four Noble Truths are this simple point. One, there is suffering, right? But what's really important about that, and this is where sometimes we hear these Buddhist teachings and, oh, life is suffering. You just go boom into this. It's kind of a bit depressing. We kind of think, well, excuse me, I know it is already, don't keep repeating it, you know. I don't need to be told, I'm not stupid. This is true. But what's interesting in Buddha's presentation of suffering, there are different levels of it which we'll describe, the reason to think about suffering is in the context of the third one, the third noble truth, which is Buddha's statement that and this is his point I'm just saying before, that there is a state called freedom from suffering, which means being depolluted. As I said, it's our natural state, to be non-suffering. To be non-neurotic, non-polluted, you know. So the first one, looking at even what suffering is, has to be seen in the context of the third one, which is that there is freedom from it. So that's the point. Because let's face it, if it were true that we could not chain suffering, which is generally speaking the view in the West, then it would be really foolish, I would agree, to concentrate on what is suffering. It's kind of like just self-pity. It's totally absurd. You wouldn't go on about it. The only reason to go on about it, to look at it deeply, to meditate on it, to look at the different levels of it, to really taste it, is so that in the context of the fact that you can get the hell out of it. This is the point, you see. So then that brings you to the second one, which is the causes of it. And that's the crucial point. This is the one. This is to where we have to identify. The first one is identifying the nature of the pollution. The second one is identifying what causes it. The causes of it, so that you can do the fourth one, which is do the actual work of getting out of it, you know, which is what the third one is saying, that you can be free of it. This is the point. It's a practical presentation, you know. So what's suffering? Let's ask. There's obvious level. There's one presentation of suffering. Buddhism always likes to have everything in packages, you know. So there's the Four Noble Truths, and now there's one called the Three Levels of Suffering. So the first one is ordinary, everyday, ordinary, we all know about it, suffering, headaches and pain and overweight and depressed and anxious and all that stuff. Ordinary, gross level, being poor, you know, being hungry, all this stuff, the gross level of very evident suffering. And we can look around on the earth, there it all is, you know. It's evident. Whether you're the most beautiful person in the universe, you get suffering at some point. No one can avoid, you know. Another way of saying that is you get born, you grow up, you get sick, and you die. One level of talking about suffering. This is clear. No one has to sort of think too much about this. So the second level is more hard to see. In fact, it's impossible to see because we don't call it suffering. Actually, what Buddha's saying here, and I'm going to be talking about the causes of suffering, which is the second noble truth, as well as the actual state of it, because this is helping us then understand the nature of why we have this suffering, which in Buddhist terms is what brings us into this wheel of life and keeps it going, you know, because this consciousness, like I said before, doesn't begin at conception and certainly will not end at death. This is Buddhist view. Consciousness is indestructible, in fact. There's a very subtle level of our consciousness, which is what in fact goes into that egg and sperm. And they actually call it, Buddhism refers to it as the indestructible consciousness. It's the subtlest level of our being, if you like, that doesn't ever disappear and doesn't ever begin. And it, if you like, carries all the imprints. And this is the idea of karma, which I'm going to get into when we talk about suffering and the causes of it, okay? The whole concept of karma, let's go into that a bit, and we'll go back to the one of suffering. Karma, the whole idea of karma is central, like I'm saying, absolutely central. It is Buddha's presentation of how come reality is the way it is. You know, Christians have the view of God, this and that. You know, Stephen Hawking puts his view of black holes and blah, blah, blah. You know, whatever. Everyone's got these different views. Well, Buddhism has all these detailed explanations of physical reality, which, interestingly, are very similar to some of the Western findings, you know, of physical reality. But the view of, you know, how we all experience what we experience and why we feel what we feel and how come universes begin and how come all these things happen, this is all contained in Buddha's concept of karma. Karma, you know. Like I said, if you want to find a creator in Buddhism, we have to look to individual living beings, our own minds, our own consciousnesses. We all, in Buddhist terms, we all create our own reality, but from life to life to life to life, in this consciousness, in this continuity of consciousness. So one of the whole ideas of karma is that whatever you think, for example, whatever you feel, if you check in your mind, you know, which we do through meditation, to really observe our own self deeply, become super familiar with who we really are, right? We will discover we might have a quality or a propensity called anger, kindness, generosity. Each one is different, you know, we can all see. And all these words, and we only know there's only so many of these words, there's only so many emotional states, you know, we've got. Okay, we complicate it and get more and more complicated as we get on. But generally speaking, we can all say, we all know these words. We all hear love, kindness, compassion, generosity, patience, neurosis, anger, depression, lying, stealing, killing. I mean, we all know these. We can all see we all have different tendencies. We're all like packages, variations on the same theme, aren't we? Some have more anger. Some have less kindness. Some have more generosity. You understand? So we have to first observe all of these. Now, a very fundamental point of karma, one of them, is that if, you know, we tend to think in the Western view that it comes from our mother, comes from our father, or just some accident, just some random event. I'm just this way. I have no idea why I'm like this. I've always been like this. It's just who I am, you know, we say. Buddha says it's come simply, it's there because you've practiced it. That's all. You know, you're angry now, honey, because you've practiced anger. Now, I can say to myself, from the time I was born, from the time I can remember, anger was there, and my mother will attest to it. From the time I came out of the womb, it was evident there was this angry person, right? So anger was a quality in Rabina's mind, right? So she didn't learn it from her mother and father. Well, you pick up your hand, you look angry, you punch the man in the nose. That's how you be angry, Rabina. She did not teach me. Believe me. It was spontaneous. So that spontaneity of it, which we think kind of, well, it's just who I am, that simply is because I have practiced it enough and I brought the imprints of it in my subtle consciousness, in my my indestructible consciousness, the imprints of it from previous practice of anger. Mother Teresa, all the imprints of her propensities were in her consciousness from the time she was conceived. Her mother didn't make her. Hitler, he wasn't created by his mummy, you know. He didn't become this monster because his mummy was very wicked. Excuse me, no one talked about her, you know, Hitler's mother doing outrageous things. I mean, she must have been a pretty heavy-duty mother. Or Mother Teresa's especially holy. Neither of those, you know. They brought, each of them, the imprints of each of their propensities in their own consciousness from their past, simply their past practice of having done it. That's it, you know. This is the general energy of karma, is we do what we practice to do. We all know ourselves in this life. If you do something often enough, it comes spontaneously, doesn't it? We all know that. So, you know, all Buddha's saying is this point, that if you're angry, if you're kind, if you're generous, it's because you've easily, let's say, it's because you've done it often enough and you brought the imprint of it and you just carried on, honey. Mozart, you know, he didn't just, you know, he didn't have an especially good music teacher. He happened to have strong imprints of music within him from having done it before. His mum gave him the piano at the age of two or whatever, and off he went, you know, easy. Just came out flying, you know, because he had the practice. We can see, this is the fundamental idea of karma, one of them, is that we continue to do what we've habitually done, and that we bring that from our previous energy. Because this consciousness, this is the whole idea here, this consciousness, this very indestructible, very subtle level of our conscious being, beyond which we can't be subtler. You know, and we never access that at all. That's super, super subtle. It's like bears all the imprints. And that came from, in a period of, was in the, between this life, from this life, from when, from the time of Rabindra's conception to the, you know, there was probably a maximum amount of 49 human days, they tend to say in the teachings, from when I was in a previous body. And there can be any kinds of body. This is what I'm going to get to about Wheel of Life, okay? It could have been any kind of body. An ant body, a dog body, a spirit body, a hell being body, a god body. There's different realms of existence. So maybe now is the time to talk about this. We'll go back to the suffering one in a minute, okay? Okay, what Buddha's asserting is this. Buddha's view of the universe, if you like, or universes for that matter, is that we've got all these, the basis is consciousnesses, beings, sentient beings. This term in Tibetan, sentient beings, odd phrase in English, or sometimes living beings, if the term is used. The Tibetan word is Semchen, having mind, Semchen, or mind having, actually. Sem is mind. Yeah. So that's a noun. You are a having mind. So a mind possessor, you know, if you like, consciousness, and that's a sentient being. So there are countless, in Buddhist terms, there are countless sentient beings, countless. There's an infinite number in the sense that it's uncountable, but there's a finite number. Because what's interesting, like I said before, consciousness wasn't created at some point. You know, if you could keep tracing your consciousness back from this life to a previous one, this continuity, like I'm saying, each moment, and you know, you have to keep this logical one of, you know, the energy being before, a certain kind, the tree, you've got to trace back the tree to the previous tree, to the previous tree, to the previous tree, to the previous tree. You'll find a long sort of history, you know, what do you call? Family tree, isn't it? The family tree will be there. So it's like the family tree of your own mind. You trace it back. The one that went into the egg and sperm. The previous moment, where was it? The previous moment before, whenever it was, and something, you know, whatever year, moment, there was conception of Rabina. The previous moment, the previous moment, the previous moment. You keep going. Well, 49 human days before that, it was in another. That subtle consciousness had left the time of death of another being, and then went into this intermediate state, and due to karmic causes and conditions, infinite number, all created by Rabina. Imprints. Left in Rabina's consciousness from her previous activity that created the cause for her consciousness to be on autopilot to go into the next mummy's womb, and off she goes now becoming Rabina. So whatever she does as Rabina, or carrying out, if she just follows her usual propensities of anger and meanness and all the rest, then you know, this is now referring to this idea of suffering. All the negative stuff inside us, if we look at our imprints, look at our propensities, the stuff that we all call negative, without too much heavy duty, it's just simply we all accept, you know, anger, jealousy, pride, mean, nasty, depression, all these things that cause us so much pain, they are the cause of our suffering. That's what Buddhism's saying. This is the second noble truth, back to that thing now. The cause of our suffering is our own neurotic states of mind. Our anger, our jealousy, our attachment, our pride, our confusion, our fears, all of this stuff, they are the pollutions, if you wish. And they're the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering. So those imprints, let's say Rabina in this life, due to past habit, let's say these particular ones, she completely feeds into those because they're the ones that she's practiced well. They just come so easily. To be mean, to be nasty, to hit people, to be angry, let's say like that, okay? So she just follows those naturally. And you look how we tend to in our lives, we tend to follow our feelings, don't we? We seem to think it's so special to follow our feelings. Because I feel it, it's me. What do we, you know, what choice have I got, we say? And this is the big ignorance we've got, you know? If I just follow all that, then in Buddhist terms, I am just deeply imprinting in my consciousness that when it, at the time of death, you know, the grosser level of Rabina ceases and then it gets right down to the very subtle level of consciousness, which is eventually what leaves the body, you know, then it will be imprinted with lots of garbage. And that garbage itself, those delusions, those carrying out of all that nonsense, have literally created the cause for Rabina's consciousness. When it leaves Rabina's body and stops technically being Rabina, it's carrying now all these imprints of negativity that will can only possibly ripen as suffering for this same consciousness in another body. Only suffering. Because the fundamental picture of karma, the fundamental principle, another fundamental principle of karma, is that if whatever you label suffering necessarily is caused by a negative action or karma of your body, speech and mind, a negative one, which leaves an imprint in your consciousness, which when it ripens, like seeds or imprints, a seed really, it will ripen as a fruit necessarily called suffering, your suffering. And equally the same with the stuff that we call positive energy. We don't need God or Buddha to tell us that love, kindness, generosity are so-called positive. We all know this intuitively. Even dogs know it. They don't know the words, but you treat a dog kindly, how will it respond, you know? It's so evident. It's not religious, you know, it's just fact. We can see. And they're called kindness, love, patience, generosity, all these things. They're the so-called positive ones. So actions or karmas done out of those actions, those energies, necessarily leave imprints in Rabina's subtle consciousness that at the time of death will then put her consciousness on autopilot if they are the ones that are most prevalent. And then it will necessarily go to a body of a life that will be in which she will experience happiness in general. Okay? Happiness is the fruit of positive energy. Suffering is the fruit of negative energy. This is a fundamental principle. And the point is about this too. It's not a judgment by God or somebody. You are a naughty person, now you will suffer. It's not that. It's an innate energy. The energy itself of anger in Rabina's mind, when acted upon, will bring to Rabina, forget about everybody else whom she harms, we're looking at her now, will bring to her suffering experiences. It's something innate. It's something nothing to do with punishment or reward. There's no concept like that in Buddhism. It's got nothing to do with it. The whole idea of karma is that it's the nature of actions, the nature of negative energy, that it will bring suffering, will ripen as suffering. The nature of positive energy is what it will ripen as happiness. So it's got nothing to do with somebody else seeing you do something good or bad, saying you're a nice person, judging you as a bad person. Nothing to do with that. It is simply the nature of actions, you know, the nature of karma. This is the Buddhist idea. So this continuity of consciousness, right, which is a beginningless and an endless continuity of energy, each moment, being what they call in samsara. Now this word samsara, again, we mystify it, like some kind of wicked place where you have pleasure that's opposite to nirvana, you know. Nothing to do with that. Samsara actually is a word, just like enlightenment, you refer it to your state of mind. It's a word referring to the state of mind of the person who is caught up in the pollutions. That's all. Caught up in neurosis and anger and jealousy and attachment and confusion. Therefore, is because of a fundamental pollution, which I'll talk about in a minute, which is the root pollution and which is the root cause of continuing to be caught up in the cycle of rebirth. The cycle of rebirth. This is the Buddhist idea, you know. So, creator, we are the creators. Not in the sense of magic wand creating, but over eons, it's like everything's an evolutionary process, you know. And it's each being itself, each person is experiencing the fruit of their past actions, and each person, whether they're positive or negative. So every being that exists, a scorpion, if you think of a scorpion, you know, it's just this energy. We can look at it, we get this energy, even though, you know, we mightn't directly see its consciousness and understand all the causes of its suffering, but it essentially is the fruit of its past energy. And if we, you know, without looking too deep, we'd have to say it's negative. I mean, scorpion itself is like in the nature of just paranoia and fear, isn't it? Look what it brings up in other people. Because one other level of karma is that how we treat people is how we get treated. So a being whose body itself is like a poison weapon, isn't it? Its body itself. That's kind of heavy duty. Dalai Lama said, you know, these hands, I remember him saying, they're made for affection. They're soft, you know. You check the claws of the lion. Excuse me, what are they made for? For ripping out the flesh of the buffalo for breakfast, for God's sake. And that is, that lion, that scorpion, they are the manifestations of their own past energy. some aspect of those energies. There are countless karmas in our mind, but some, only some ripen at any one life, you know. So a lion is the manifestation. And look how she acts, you know. Just have to look at her. We say, oh, that's natural. That's just nature, we say. Well, nothing is just nature in Buddhist terms. It's the result of past actions. Every being that exists is the result of its past energy. Every being that exists. Hitler, Mother Teresa, scorpions, lions, you know. Each person, each being is the living manifestation. And without too much deep thinking, if you observe the way lion functions, that mummy lion, the way she is unbelievably skillful at stalking another sentient being. Why? So she can rip its flesh out for breakfast. I mean, this one I always vividly remembered. I keep quoting this one from my own experience. Yeah, this one particular animal show. Showing exactly that, this lion, you know. And this buffalo clearly doesn't want to be eaten, thank you very much, because it wants to be happy too. But you know, so there it is, it becomes the meal for this lion family. And that lion will do anything from her massive attachment, her enormously powerful wanting energy, and her huge aggression, naturally, you know, it's her nature, because of her past actions, to actually see a sentient being, not as a sentient being, to not feel the suffering of the buffalo. She's utterly oblivious to that. Why? Because she's overwhelmed by her own need for food, and her method from her past habit is to rip flesh out of beings, to harm beings. Now, excuse me, if that's not negative, I'm not criticizing her. It's suffering too, that's the point. Because the crucial point of this is negativity brings to you suffering. So that lion is the fruit of her own past actions. That consciousness, maybe as a human, with harming others, vindictive, you know, arrogant, aggressive, huge attachment, getting their own needs, unbelievable imprints to harm other people. Just look at the human world, for God's sake. So, due to karma, that being, that karmic strong, particular karmic seed for it to be a lion rebirth, ripened at the time of her death, that consciousness now on autopilot, all those other karmic seeds called lion ripen, she zaps into lion mummy's womb, off she goes, you know, with her big claws, doing lion thing. That's the fruit of past actions. She is the product of her own past. No one created her. She's not a product of something called God. She's not a product of something called Mother Nature. She's a sentient being with a consciousness that's beginningless like yours, that possesses Buddha nature like yours. She wants to be happy like you. She doesn't want to suffer like you. But look how she acts. And that's the point of the Buddha's saying we have to look at. Forget even about the lion suffering. We have to look at what we are doing now in the hope and the wish that it brings us happiness like the lion. But in fact, to see how what we're doing is bringing unbearable suffering. This is sort of one approach too. You know, this is the cause of suffering. That what we're doing now, although we want to be happy, lion wants to be happy, but she sees eating buffalo as her only means, because that's just the imprints in her consciousness, tunnel vision, that's it. You can tell a lion every day for eons that buffaloes don't want to be eaten for breakfast. They suffer terribly. It's not a possibility for her consciousness to get it, because the imprints are so powerful to be just that lion. And this, so the lion being that aggressive lion, that itself, not even causing, talking about what she's causing to the buffalo, but her own energy itself is unbearable suffering. To have that amount of neediness, that amount of aggression, is unbearable suffering. If you yourself try and, you know, just think, try and put yourself in the place of a lion. And this is something interesting about Buddhist psychology, by the way, that Buddha's presentation of consciousness and mind and how it functions, which is very extensive, this applies to all living beings, not just to humans, you know. If you look at a lion, you can see neediness, aggression, violence, attachment, just like you know yourself, but not as intense at all. Look at them, you know. We're more intellectual, definitely. We're more sophisticated in how we harm. But we look at the gross level of that lion's mind, and you try and relate to that and think of yourself being so overwhelmed by your hunger that you're oblivious to your next door neighbor being human. All you see is flesh. Your need to eat is so overwhelming. Try and think of that. If you don't realize that suffering, then that's just a joke, isn't it? It's unbearable. Even when you're slightly hungry yourself and your neediness is overwhelming for that cake, and you take it from you take the second piece, you don't care about the person. But to start eating their body, try and imagine how intense that is, that neediness. You know, well, that's the suffering of a lion, you know. And that's come from imprints of attachment. And her aggression, all that, is the manifestation of her own, when maybe a human, the wish to harm others. All this energy we have in the mind, the vindictiveness, the raging, the blaming, the resentment, all this stuff. It grows and grows and grows. Karma ripens, mind goes into mummy's womb, boom! Perfect vehicle for vindictiveness and aggression to come out. A lion is made for aggression. That's it. And she is the creation of her own past energy. This is the way it is. So, okay, what in this wheel of life, why does this consciousness, which is what Buddha's saying, why does it go from so-called life to life? And what is that all about? So looking now, we're looking really at the causes, which is now looking at the second noble truth again, the causes of suffering. What are the causes? Because we can really indeed, if we look even cursorily, even at that gross level, you know, the suffering of being a buffalo, the suffering of being the lion, back and forth, the fear, the paranoia they live in, that's a fairly gross level of suffering. So let's even look just now at the general cause of suffering, but then we can go more deeply back to the point of really looking at the deeper levels of what suffering is, you know. Because we need to know those in order to want to give them up. This is the point. So the fundamental cause of suffering, in general, the cause of suffering in Buddhism is the deluded states of mind we all possess. And deluded is a very interesting word. It's one, it indicates one characteristic of the states of mind. There's another characteristic, these states of mind that are the cause of suffering, that is also a translation of the Tibetan term. It's called afflicted emotions. Or afflictions, they often just use the term afflictions, which sounds kind of weird. We wouldn't use that normally in our lives, would we? Afflictive emotions. Well, or there's another term. What are some of the other terms? Where's Brian? What's funny happened to him? Where is he? Did he go? Never mind. Huh? What is another term they use for emotions? Can you think? Jack? No? Okay. So one is, huh? Judith? Another word for afflicted emotions they use. Okay, that's the other one. Which one? Obscurations? No, that's different. No, that's different. Okay, doesn't matter. So these states of mind that we, let's say look at some of those. Attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, okay? That's four. We all know these words, don't we? To some extent, we all know the feelings. So there's... This word delusion is indicating one of the characteristics. And the thing is, to get to understand these states of mind, we need to go very deeply into them. And this is the Buddhist approach in meditation. It's very necessary to go deeply into them, to really comprehend and taste their characteristics. So one characteristic of these states of mind, and this is something we do not look at, is the deluded aspect, the deluded characteristic. And what this means is that what Buddha's saying is that anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, for example, when they're in the mind very strong, you know, what they do is they cause a distortion in our experiences. So when you're strongly angry, you know, if I'm angry at this man, we all know when the anger is strong, it's like there's a deluded aspect to it, isn't it? It's like I can't really see clearly where he's at. I had this view of my own views so strongly, don't I? He is horrible. He did this. He did that. How dare he? You understand what I'm saying? So the deluded aspect is that when that anger is there, it's like you're clouded. You can't see clearly, really, what's going on there. Attachment, just the same. Attachment, the deluded aspect of attachment is that it makes the object look truly delicious. Let's say I'm in love with this man. Then he looks like an angel, right? Just divine. The tip of his head to the tip of his toenail. He looks so delicious. And I don't see anything neurotic. You know, I have a fantasy picture. So that's the deluded characteristic. One of the particular characteristics of all these emotions that causes so much suffering. These causes of suffering. Now the other one is they're afflicted in the sense that they are they're very strong. You all see it when you're very angry. It's the intensity of the emotion is quite overwhelming, isn't it? And it's really disturbing. Oh, you're disturbing emotions. Lama Zopa says disturbing emotions. That's a very good one. They're disturbed. When you're angry, you are so disturbed, aren't you? You can't sleep, you can't eat, you're beside yourself. We all know that. So there's one characteristic of these causes of suffering, and these are the names of the pollutions, right? Is that they're disturbed. I mean, literally disturbed. So that's the best, that was the term I was looking for, disturbed. We all know that. But the other one, which we mightn't think of so often, is they're deluded. They don't see clearly how things are. They're deluded, you know. That's exactly the lion. The intensity of the aggression of the lion is so overwhelming that she is incapable of seeing the truth of the buffalo, that buffalo is suffering. And if that's not deluded, Lord knows what is. Do you see my point? When you say a person is really deluded, it's like they're living in la-la land. You know what I'm saying? Well, that's exactly what Buddha's saying. We're all living in la-la land. We've all got some fantasy about reality, and what it's coming through and from is these strong, disturbed emotions, these afflicted emotions, these delusions in our mind. That's what, and these are the cause of our suffering. Right now they cause our suffering, that's the point. They cause our suffering right now. I think when he did that mean thing, that he is the cause of my suffering, don't we? And this is one of the major things we have to learn to see by looking into our own mind and understanding karma. We know, we believe absolutely that this man is the cause of our suffering. What all Buddha is saying is, sorry, Ravina, he is true. His fist caused the blood to come out of your nose. No disputing that. But, Ravina, if you're suffering right now, it's not because of his fist. You're suffering because of your own personal emotions, your own anger, your own resentment, your own bitterness, your own fury that you're experiencing in response to that. Now, okay, that sounds outrageous, but we all know that's how we see things now. And Buddha's saying we have to learn to be incredibly precise in our own analysis of our own mind in order to really see this one, to own our part of it. So this is now looking at the causes of suffering, the second noble truth. That Ravina's delusions, number one, cause her to suffer right now, when because she gets angry and bitter and resentment and full of fear and all the rest when he punches me. So her own delusions now are the cause of her suffering. But there's a second cause of her suffering too, which is how come he in the first place punched me? How come we even meet? How come he's, you know, that he sees me and is full of rage and goes boom? How come? Now, this is interesting. Most of us would say, well, it's just life. It's just random. I've never met the man in my whole life. Look at him. Bumps out of his car, road rage, and punches me in the nose, right? And we just say, well, it's just random. That's just the way life is. Well, Buddha's saying, excuse me, that is an outrageous idea. That's completely ignorant to think that anything can be random. We think we're so scientific, you know. We are so scientific when it comes to certain things. We would never posit. No scientist would ever just say, well, you just, rose bushes grow. I have no idea why. Nobody knows, you know. Just rose bushes pop up, right? We'd be embarrassed to say that. Look how detailed our scientific analysis is when it comes to rose bushes and the causes of rose bushes. And I remember reading Stephen Hawking's book, you know, that, what do you call, Brief History of Time. And it struck me, something he said in there. He said, we have almost come to know the mind of God. By learning all the stuff that he's learned about, which is kind of outrageous, you know, amazing, I think. It's extraordinary what they've learned. But, as he said, and this is a significant point, it hasn't helped us learn the first thing about human behavior. And that is a very telling point. That's exactly Buddha's point. Because the mind is the cause of suffering. Now, not only is Ravina's present anger the cause of her suffering when, what's your name?
Stephen,
when Stephen punches me in the nose. Okay? Rabina's anger is the cause of the suffering right now. Stephen's punch is a secondary cause. It's a catalyst for Rabina's suffering. And there's a secondary point here too, is it doesn't mean that he's right. Just because my anger is the cause of my suffering doesn't mean he's right to punch me. And that's another story, okay? We're looking at Rabina's suffering now. So the main cause now is the present delusion. But the main cause is my past action, a past action necessarily of negativity, because now I'm experiencing suffering, necessarily of negativity in relation to precisely this consciousness. Now he's labeled Stephen. Now I'm labeled Ravina. Who knows? Could have been my mother in a past life, my sister or Fred, or I could have been his dog, or who knows, you know. But we have this karmic connection, because nothing is random according to Buddhism. There's a karmic connection between us, which means our two consciousnesses have interacted before, and this particular experience of him punching me in the nose is the ripening of a similar kind of energy from the past. Now, obviously, it can't have been that I kissed him and was kind to him, because right now he'd be kissing me back and being kind to me. But right now, he meets me, never met me before. He sees this ridiculous person. He can't bear me because I interrupted him on the road. He sees this maniac. He gets out of his car. He hates me, full of rage. Boom. Punches me. It is not an accidental activity. It is not a random event. There is cause and condition and logic to this, just like the rose bush, you know. And Western scientists have found out how rose bushes grow. Well, you know, mental scientists find out how punches grow. That's all. And that's the Buddhist idea, you know. So the cause of suffering is two things. One, the past action that I did of negativity necessarily, that particular action, of harming that person in a past life, then two, the present anger and hurt in my own mind at the moment. They are the two causes, karma and delusion. Karma and delusion, that's how they say. This is the cause of suffering. Now, the root cause of suffering, of even why in the first place I have anger, why in the first place a person punches me, why I have any suffering at all, why I'm even reborn when my consciousness dies into another suffering life. The root cause, the mother of all of the delusions, if you wish, the major pollution. This is one they call kind of, you can talk about it kind of colloquially as ego grasping. Ego grasping. Known generally as ignorance in Buddhism, marimpa, Rigpa means awareness, which is the fundamental function of our conscious being, to simply be aware. And a Buddha is a being who's got absolute perfect awareness of utterly how everything exists since beginningless time up to endless time. Sees all reality as it is. That's kind of like absolute Rigpa, if you want. Just talking, rough words. So, ma is the negative. Ma Rigpa, unawareness. So right now, in Buddha's saying, the major pollution in our consciousness is this fundamental ma Rigpa, this unawareness of how actually everything exists finally, ultimately, the true nature of how everything is. These are the words Buddhism uses, you know? This is one, though, but this ma Rigpa is so pervasive and is so subtle and so deep and so ancient in us, so spontaneous, that we're not aware of it. It's like it colours everything we see and do and say and think. There's never a fraction of a second when we're free of this ma Rigpa. So it's kind of like it's kind of like you're colourblind. Or like you've got you've got sort of pink lenses in your eyes. So everything, as long as those lenses are there, everything you perceive through your eyes is tinted by pink. Do you understand what I'm saying? And you don't have a moment when you just see, oh, there's not really pink after all. You have this little space where you see it really as it is. And then you go back to being pink again. That's easy. No, it's continuously, everything is constantly looking the wrong way to you. So you never have a fraction of a second when you don't see everything as pink. So if someone's going to say to you, Rina, things aren't pink. But you can't conceive of this because you only know pink. Well, that's this ma Rigpa. It's like a fundamental delusion that's been in our minds since beginningless time that is the root cause of how come there's even this separate, independent, real, solid Rubina-ness in the first place. And the ma Rigpa, this ego-grasping, clings absolutely to this sense of me-ness as a separate entity. Separate. Independent. Separate. Cut off. You, me, other. Like this, you know. Separate. And this is something utterly innate within us. It's completely ancient and is the root of our suffering. This is the root cause of suffering. The mother of them all, you know. The other ones are the voices of this one. So, you know, it's like positing a separate independent, which sounds weird to us because we can't even conceive of not being a separate independent. It sounds too weird to be anything other than this, you know. We don't even know the alternative. But the very fact that we've got this strong, fundamentally mistaken sense of an I is what then gives rise to I want, which is the neediness of attachment. Attachment effectively is the major cause of our suffering in day-to-day life. But the cause of why even there's an I in the first place, which we wouldn't even think of as suffering, it sounds depressing to think of there being the opposite, is this ma Rigpa, this ego-grasping. But attachment is the main voice of that one, I want. So the more powerful we have ego grasping, ironically, you know, ego, we tend to think of it as big and good and strong, and it's important to understand this correctly, the more strong we posit this separate, independent, real, solid I-ness, the more strongly we have I want. Meaning, the more miserable, the more lonely, the more alienated, separate, cut off, lonely, suffering, poor lonely me, the more, you know, self-pity me, as Lama Yeshe's calls ego. Very tasty. Self-pity me. That's the irony of ego. That's in fact the energy of I, is poor me. So then poor me is always hungry, so poor me is always needy and attached and grasping. At what? People and sounds and smells and reputation and tastes and all the rest. And we project our neediness onto other things. Why? Because we want to be happy. That's valid. But, and this is the point, Buddha's saying, you want to be happy? Perfect. But please excuse me, you're using the wrong methods. You will never get it through this rubbish. By following all the pollution, the ego-grasping, and then the I want. So what we do is this massive neediness, this wish to be happy, which is not necessarily the attachment. The wish to be happy is just perfect. It's a natural thing. But it's polluted by attachment, which makes up a story, projects its neediness onto the person, onto Stephen, onto the objects, onto the coffee, onto the tea, onto the smells, onto the taste, onto the reputation. It's completely, you know, this is a dualistic view of reality. But Lama Yeshe calls it schizophrenic. Very appropriate, very tasty, you know. The self-pity me living in the schizophrenic self-created universe of me and other, delicious, ugly, beautiful, and all the delicious, ugly, the delicious stuff are the causes of my happiness, so I grasp at them, try to consume them through every hole possible, desperately wanting to be happy like the junkie. And then the ugly, horrible, mean, awful things, push them away because they're the cause of my suffering. And this is what our life is right now. We can all see. Okay, so I'm kind of caricaturing it, but we all know what I'm talking about. This is suffering, you know. And the cause of it is simply action similar to it from the past. You keep the ball rolling, you know. That's the wheel of life. We just keep going, attachment to life, you know, energy, misery, nasty. You just keep getting reborn, honey. More suffering, more misery, more lions, more buffaloes, more ants, more scorpions, you know, more Hitlers. That's it. I mean, this is Buddha's view of reality. This is how it all comes about. This is Buddha's diet. It's not God who did it. It's not some accident. It's not the devil. It's not someone else. Every bit of it has logic in Buddhist terms. Every bit of it has an evolutionary process from before, you know. This is the Buddhist idea of reality, just roughly speaking. Maybe it's question time. That's wheel of life. Does anybody have any questions or points to make? Please. Okay, it doesn't matter. I'm happy to keep talking. Yes, go on. Yes, yes. Yes, yes.
How is that different from the concept of Atman?
I think the concept of Atman is really similar to the Christian view of soul, and it's not so much a question of it being something that exists always that is a disputed point. It's more the way it exists. So I think the Buddhist, and this is at the philosophical level, the Buddhists would argue about the way that the soul, what is labeled soul or Atman, you know, and maybe you could even say, very roughly speaking, that very subtle consciousness is that one. You could say that perhaps. But it's more, the differences are in how it exists. It's more the presentation of the way it exists. So roughly speaking, I think the Christian and the Hindu views of Atman, thank you very much, yeah, would be that it's, that's it. Would be that it has an innate existing from its own side, always perfect existence, like the concept of God. Buddhism would dispute that. Buddhism says everything is interdependent. Everything is cause and effect. Nothing has an innate from its own side good or bad nature. And so Atman or soul, maybe you can say, you know, very subtle consciousness, is it's in how it exists, that's all. It's the way of being an interdependent, empty phenomenon. So that's the difference, I would say. It's in the way they philosophically present its very existence at all, and indeed where it comes from. So I think even the Hindus would say Atman comes from... How does Atman come about? Is it self-created? Is it created by one of the Hindu gods or what? Do you know? No. Well, I know certainly the Christian view say it comes from God.
So would you say that the fundamental difference lies in the suchness of it?
In this emptiness, yeah. In this interdependence.
Suchness
is meaning emptiness. Yeah. Suchness is another word referring to emptiness in Buddhist terms. Suchness is a good term, yes. It's just as it is-ness, yes. Everything as it is-ness, yes. But that is in Buddhist terms, its ultimate nature is that it is empty of existing from its own side. It doesn't have an innate self-existent nature. This is the one that is the opposite to Marigpa. When we have the wisdom that is completely conquering Marigpa, conquering the ego grasping, that's when you know have achieved nirvana. So we're talking high level here. Somebody else, please? Any questions at all about anything?
How is it possible if you, when you die, you are upset or angry?
Yes. It wouldn't be possible. You wouldn't be born as a person.
It is not possible. Mm. Where the imprint from our
Yes. Language. Okay, very good. Good point. Perfect point. Okay. There are different ways that karma ripens. One way is called the ripened result, which is the type of rebirth. So let's say your consciousness. From the past life, at the time of the death, let's say you were a human in the past life, just to say, and you, at the time of the death of that person, because of practice in that life, and in fact Buddhism would say why you even are who you are in this life is because of unbelievable virtue in a past life, enormous amount of practice in relation especially to probably a spiritual practice, keeping the vows of morality, a strong aspiration to want to have a human birth again, to want to practice a spiritual path, which is why you'd be even sitting here now, okay, in general. But the crucial one is at the time of death. Let's say because you've practiced in your life and you've practiced morality and patience and kindness, and you've perhaps even thought about death and given up attachment and all this, so at the time of your death would necessarily be peaceful death. Because at the time of death, in general, for all beings, as long as we are in samsara, a very strong level of grasping would ripen. Very strong. Now, if, on the other hand, that ripen, it's going to ripen whether you have a good rebirth or a negative one. And that is like an energy that propels you into the next life. But it's a question then whether, at the time of death, whether the habit of peacefulness and morality causes a particular one karmic seed to ripen. Or if, say, at the time of, which it must have been for you in Buddhist terms, because you are what you are now. So, a strong virtue ripened at the time of death. And that became the one karmic cause to guide on autopilot your consciousness into your present mother's womb for you to get a human life. So this human body is the product of virtue. But look at Hitler. Hitler, a virtue ripened at the time of his past life which caused him to get Hitler's body, Hitler's life, Hitler's mind, human mind, as opposed to lion. But all of the other things that he did, and this is the other way that karma ripens. So karma ripens in specifically a type of rebirth. So necessarily, if a negative, a powerful negative seed ripens at the time of death, that consciousness will be guided to go into a scorpion or whatever life. But it could be born, let's say a dog, it could be born as a poodle, and then due to other karmas ripening from other imprints that come along with that one package of generosity and kindness, that dog is born to a very loving family, and it has diamond collars on its little neck, and eats the best quality livers every day, and is loved and adored, and is left in somebody's will. Do you understand? So all those other things are all the karma of other karmas, but that aren't complete karmas. So everything in this life we experience that we label suffering, including the imprints of anger, have come from habits. But then there are other, so karma ripens in terms of a total way you create it, which creates the cause for a certain life. But then the other one is just simply the habits as well. So we're a package of many, many, many karmas all ripening at different levels. Does that make sense? Does that answer? So the crucial one is, it's not enough just to get a human life. Look at the number of human lives and the humans, the intensity of their suffering. The people who've got really good minds, beautiful human minds and good bodies and good, but totally starving, can't even hardly pick up a rice grain. That's because generosity karma was missing. Why we are sitting here having anything at all, we don't think we're that rich maybe, but we have access to things so easily. Make a phone call, you get a pizza at the door. Just everything is so easy for us to get things so easily. That's because of unbelievable generosity in the past. So morality, not harming others, is the cause of why we have a human life in general. Generosity is why you have anything. That poodle, all the poodles these days getting thousands of dollars of God knows what, you know, that's because of their past generosity. But the throwing karma, they call it, that was the one that threw them from that life to the next, that was a negative one, which caused them to be the poodle body. Karma also ripens in terms of the environment. And it's in this way, at the biggest level, that Buddhism would even say this environment, this universe that we think is just nature or made by God or somebody, it too is the karmic result of the collective karmic actions of all the beings who experience it. So right now, this environment, just call this particular little piece of environment with the sunny sky and the peaceful weather. This is a karmic result of our past, certain past virtuous actions. But at this moment in time, if we're experiencing an earthquake, we say, God did it, act of God, we blame God. Or we say, it's Mother Nature. I mean, excuse me, whoever Mother Nature is, poor thing. Nothing to do with Mother Nature. In Buddhist terms, it's the collective karma of past anger and harming that is now manifesting as the earth itself crashing in on us. So we are actually the creators. And okay, in certain texts, when they say in the Kala Chakra Tantra, Lama Yeshe has said, there are detailed explanations of the relationship between external and internal reality. And so in simple terms, you know, the universe, in the way Buddhist terms describes it, is made up of the four elements. Earth, air, fire, water. The body, the earthquake, same, except there's more fire energy there than, say, you know, this body. Or the ocean, more water, that's all. And so the coming together of these four elements in any particular package is no accident, just comes from its own side, earthquakes. Yes, there are laws of earthquakes that we can look at, and that's the Stephen Hawking point I'm making. It's the universe that he's looked at, but he hasn't looked at in Buddhist terms, the main cause of it, not God or Buddha, but the individual consciousnesses who are experiencing that earthquake. So there's even this environmental karma. Killing, generally speaking, of a group of people from past action of killing, they're reborn in a situation where the food and medicine is basically conducive to ill health, not health. I mean, we normally would think of India like that, but I mean, these days, excuse me, look at our culture, look at our world. Who drinks the water out of taps anymore? It's pollution. This is the environmental karma of killing that we are now collectively experiencing, that we created. So these elements, they are magnificent, they are astonishing. The universe is amazing, but it's not a high being who did it. They simply come together in a certain form based on the energy of the collective consciousnesses that experience it. So Buddhism posits a hell realm. And as Lama Yeshe said, excuse me, that's not some place where some devil is saying, ha ha, I'm waiting for Thubten Yeshe. He said, no, that's the karmic result of the negative energy of that very being who, due to powerful negative energy, is now experiencing unbearable suffering. And it's the elements, too, because there's elements. In the tantric teachings, too, they talk about the subtle consciousness and there's very subtle physical energy as well that goes with it. And that's the basis of the growth of the four elements. So this consciousness at the time of death, your consciousness, let's say, due to virtue ripening, this ripened a virtuous seed in your mind, and there are billions of seeds in your mind. This then is connected to a very subtle wind energy which is always with your consciousness. And that's the building blocks of your next body. Based on the new womb, you know. And the building blocks of your next mind is your very subtle consciousness. Depending on which one you create, boom, into the lion's mummy, your earth, your subtle wind energy has the potential for the four elements. And it will now manifest as a lion's body. The elements of the universe are the same. It's created by consciousnesses. We are the creators of this universe, you know. So there's environmental karma. There's the karma of the habit to keep doing the same action, which is the most tragic one. Of continuing to kill. Look at children who just spontaneously stomp on snails, you know. Look at other children who burst into tears. Their mother hasn't had time to train them yet. The mother might be a killer of snails, but the child isn't. It's because she's got her own karma, her own imprints of not having killed. So that's what, but she has other things in her life. So there's the karma of the type of life you have. They call that the fully ripened karma. There's environmental karma. There's the karma of continuing to do the same action. And there's the karma of having it done to you. They're the four. And we look at the world. Just in terms of killing, you look at the world. Look how many people. So the karma of having killed, in terms of it happening back to you, is that you get killed, or you die young, or you get sick. Now look at the sickness in the world. This is one of the karmic residual results, if you like, I call it, of past action of killing that hasn't been purified. And then look at the numbers of humans who kill. We mightn't kill humans, most of us. But there's even a religion in the world except Buddhism, maybe Jainism I've heard, that teaches that you shouldn't kill any living being. It's only Buddhism really, mostly. Because even I was taught as a Catholic, with great respect, I was taught that God made all these other beings, they don't have a soul, he created them for my benefit. So it's cool to kill, you know. In Buddhism that's the most outrageous cause of your intense suffering. Look at the world. How many beings kill others? And then look at how many people get killed. Look how many beings died in the womb. I wouldn't imagine there are probably more beings humans who get to the womb but don't even get out before they're killed. Or just die naturally. Because that's the result of killing. So these four main ways that karma ripens. And in Buddhist practice, especially in the Tibetan tradition, one of the major practices we have is called purification practice. The four opponent powers. It's a psychological, four psychological steps that is purification. And each of these four purify one of these four levels of karma. So the one of doing the actual practice, you know, those of us who might, for example, do Vajrasattva, that's the third of these opponent powers called the power of the antidote. That purifies the actual lower rebirth suffering. The first one of regret, huge regret of the harm that you've done, that purifies it happening to you. So if you kill, if you purify by regretting hugely that you've harmed other beings by killing, that purifies your being harmed, it purifies you dying young, it purifies your sickness, now and in future life. That's the first noble truth, the first of the four opponent powers. That purifies that kind of karma. The one of power of reliance, they call it, relying upon the Buddha and relying upon sentient beings whom you've harmed in the past. So you take refuge in the Buddha and you make compassionate wish to benefit the sentient beings you've harmed. This one purifies environmental karma. The antidote itself, the practice, whatever it is that you do, that purifies the lower realm rebirth. And the fourth one, as Pavongka Rinpoche says, one of the most important, the determination not to do again. That's obvious what that purifies. It purifies the habit to keep doing it, you know. So not only this life, we can see how this purification practice, which is fundamental for us Buddhists, so those of us who use it as our practice, for example, and that's why it's crucial to finish the day with a practice like this, not just to do the mantras quickly, but to do the four steps. As Lama Yeshe said, purification is these four steps. It's your mind that created negativity. And so it's your mind that purifies it. Buddha doesn't purify you. You purify you. So it's the intensity of your regret, the strength of your bodhicitta and refuge. The strength of the way you do the practice and the strength of your determination not to do again. This is purification. Because we are the creators of our own reality. We create our lives. We create our suffering. And we create our happiness. It's not God. It's not someone else. The schizophrenic view we have that it's someone else doing it to us. The cake or the person or God. It's not. It's our own mind. And the cakes and the person and the everything is a creation of our own mind. It's we. As little Ling Rinpoche, this little reincarnated Lama, when he was like 5 years old, he said, "You have the power." This is the idea of Buddhism. It is we who create this universe. And it's we who create suffering. So it's we who can change it. This is the Buddhist idea. It's up to us. So anybody else got questions? I understand. No, that's interesting. No, that's an interesting point. Okay, first of all, this is Buddha's presentation, okay? But it's like, each of us practices, let's say, a thing we call a spiritual path. Each of us practices a path that makes sense to us. Now, these teachings have always been around, and maybe it's just, maybe not many people's minds relate to this approach. I mean, you've got to work with an approach that works for you. So a person, you know, I remember talking to a group of very good people, wonderful human beings in our centre in Nepal. They were Christians from Germany. They came and they were investigating Nepal and they came for a teaching about Buddhism. And I told them about the whole thing of rebirth and also, which we haven't discussed today, this whole Buddhist view of wanting to become a Buddha to benefit others, this development of enormous compassion for all living beings and being reborn and reborn again and again to benefit them. Well, in the end, they thought that was depressing. They didn't want to know about that. They want to go to heaven at the end of this life and be with God, please. Now, that's very different, isn't it? So these teachings would be, they were truly depressed by this view. They could appreciate the wisdom of it and appreciate the intelligence of it maybe and appreciate the whole idea of, you know, compassion, which they totally agree with. But excuse me, they don't want to know, you know. So everyone's got a different kind of mind. So maybe this particular approach just suits only a few minds. Who knows? I mean, that seems to be the evidence, doesn't it? Because it's in the end what, these teachings have always been around. Even just for 2,500 years, and I'll answer that point in a minute. But they've always been there, the books have been there, but it's only the last 30, 40 years that even we in the West have taken them on board, isn't it? But, you know, you read books even 70 years ago written by some of those people who went to Tibet. They're completely superstitious. There's hardly a word of truth in what those people thought and saw, you know. The view, they thought the Tibetans were outrageous, superstitious, unbelievable, ignorant people. And all the Christians tried to do was you know, what do you call? Convert them. So I mean, it's just different minds, isn't it? Different, and so the world seems to go in kind of waves of kinds of minds, isn't it? So as for the Buddha existing, in Buddhist terms, we all do possess this Buddha nature. But there are certain Buddhas, so there are countless Buddhas, in fact, in reality, existing right now. But there could be the next-door neighbour. You wouldn't see them with a halo sitting there meditating. They'd see your next-door neighbour. But they're manifesting in an ordinary form, which is the function of a Buddha, is to manifest to benefit others for as many eons as exist, in as many forms as they can. It's one of their powers. But there are Buddhas called the founding Buddhas. And there are, we're at the moment in the Buddhist cosmological view of reality, we're in an eon of time when there are 1,000 of the founding Buddhas, and we're at the time of the fourth one, which is called Shakyamuni, which is 2,500 years ago. And the next one is in however many more eons to come, and everybody has different views about when that is, it sounds like millions of years to me, is the next person called Maitreya. But that whole world view doesn't fit at all with the Western view of history, so I don't know where to fit all that, you know. I'm just giving you the Buddhist idea. So there are countless beings who have the, we all have potential to be Buddha. And we can, there are endless beings becoming Buddha, but there are only a few founding Buddhas who sort of become like the big kings of the Buddhas, you know what I'm saying? Who manifest and bring the teachings into a world at a time when they don't exist. That's the idea. Does that make sense? Does that answer your questions? You don't look satisfied? Oh, you don't have to believe a word I'm saying. I'm not asking you to believe it, I'm just giving you the answer. But if you have more questions, please ask. It's helpful for everybody. I'm not trying to convince you, I'm just trying to give you the answer. Do you want to ask more questions? Or is that enough for now? Okay.
No, I want to hear your doubt. Come on. Out with it. Debate with me. Come on. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just giving you the Buddha's answer. So what's your doubt about that? Please tell us. It's good for everybody. It's not... Yeah. Come on. Good. Please. Yes. Yes. They're ours, coming from us. Mind, I mean, meaning consciousness, who you are, they're yours. Yes. They've come from the habit of having done them before by you.
Okay, but I look at things like I'm Dan.
You're who? Dan. Yeah, okay.
So it seems to me like the mind is Dan and stuff, like you said, it's not.
What do you mean? Well, who's Dan? Dan's just a label, isn't it, for all the bits and pieces? Mind, feelings, thoughts, love, emotions, nose, eyelashes. Isn't that true? Wouldn't you just say Dan? I'm not trying to be all deep now. It's practical, isn't it? Dan is just the name for this particular person as opposed to this one, so we don't get confused.
Well, if I look at this hand, I think
yeah.
This is Dan's hand.
Sure, it is, yeah. So then, go on, keep going.
So, if I have trouble...
Uh-huh.
But
trouble with which? Where's Dan, you mean? I agree, it's a good point. But what's this got to do with the other point? Keep going on this point. It's very interesting, Dan. Come on.
Well, this thing called pollution, right?
Yes.
I can't associate, like I can say, okay, well, I get mad.
Yes, sure.
And I can say, okay, well, that's pollution.
Yes.
Of some sort.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure what it is when that pollution's gone.
Okay, you've got...
I can't relate that. Somehow I can't.
Yeah.
Like if this fist hits
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
It's
true, but it's not, but we're trying to find the root cause though, aren't we? Here what we're trying to do is find the root cause. So the fist has got a big part of it. For sure the fist hit my nose, met with my nose and caused blood to come, right? This is true. Now, what caused the fist to go out? It wasn't the fist itself. More than that. What was in Dan's mind is the question here. What was in Dan's mind? To love Robina? No, obviously not. Was to harm her. Why? We call that anger. Just crudely, don't we? We call that anger. So anger is what we recognize it was there momentarily, yeah? You agree? So if it was, the point I was saying before, one point was that the anger, now you might, you know, normally speaking, if you punch me in the nose, because I might have punched you, let's say. So usually speaking, when someone says, Dan, what's wrong? And you say, I'm very angry. And why are you angry? Robina punched me. So we normally think, it's the way we think about anger, this is the first point, is we tend to think that with my fist, kind of it injected anger into you somehow, that anger came out of my fist into you and then it came out of you. But all Buddha's saying is, first of all, anger is a quality, a propensity within Dan, one of the many qualities of Dan, that was there from having had done it before fairly easily. That's why it popped up so easily this time. So it's a propensity. So, okay, getting now more precise, anger is a quality, not of your fist, but of your mind. The fist is the agent of the mind, wouldn't you agree? The fist is the agent of the anger, wouldn't you agree? Just in general. The fist isn't, you don't think the fist has a little mini brain, do you, that does its own trip? Do you see what I'm saying? It's just... Okay, so we're breaking it down. So we have body and we have consciousness in Buddha's terms. And there's no other components. Consciousness is a label in Buddha's terms that refers to the entirety of the inner experiences of Dan. So in other words, if we wanted to remove all the bits that weren't consciousness, what we'd end up with is Dan's body, basically. Everything about Dan. Anything that we can see or cut, no matter how miniature, that's Dan's body. The consciousness is the energy that kind of puts it into life. The difference between Dan's, a dead body and a live body, is the presence of consciousness. Put it like that. So consciousness or mind, these are the words in Buddhist terms that refer to the whole spectrum of feelings, thoughts, emotions, intellectual, unconscious, subconscious, all the way down to what these subtler levels that we're positing, okay? The whole spectrum of the Dan-ness of Dan that isn't the body of Dan. That's consciousness, that's mind. Now, Dan. When we think of Dan, we tend to think, well, if I broke all the bits down, I'm going to have three bundles, three little piles. Dan's consciousness, Dan's body, and then there's Dan left. Excuse me. We know perfectly well that's not true. Cup. This is one of the analysis they do when they try to find the ultimate nature of reality, how things don't exist from their own side. This is exactly the analysis. But you know, this is called mala, okay? Now, I say, just like we do with Dan, my mala has red beads, my mala has red string, my mala has a skull bead. So we think, okay, where's mala? Because this is the investigation we need to do to discover the ultimate nature of Dan and everything else, which is finally when you achieve nirvana, which is the liberation from suffering, which cuts the maripa. This is the wisdom, okay? And it's the maripa, the ignorance, the grasping, that grasps at a real Dan from his own side existing innately, a real mala from its own side existing from its own side in and of itself, less. This is the fundamental pollution. Okay, so in this analysis, in this investigation, what we do is we think we're beginning to see how mala, this is okay, mala arises. This is the teachings on dependent arising, which is Lama Tsongkhapa's particular way of presenting the flip side of emptiness. It's the dependent arising, the conventional level of reality. This is a particular way of presenting it. And it's very tasty. I can't just stop between mala and cup. Okay. So, in order to investigate mala, Dan, we have to do the same thing. We start to analyze. This is analyzing it in relation to its parts, which is a subtler level. And one does this for ages in meditation, right? Not just cursorily. Then you start to break it down into its component parts, because you're trying to find the mala-ness that we kind of cling to, the I that rises when someone insults Dan, that freaks out when someone hurts him, that panics when he won't get what he wants. There's this, like this owner that walks around that we really feel so strongly and believe in totally, isn't it? So, mala, we think, okay, it's got its bead. We put the beads all there. We put the string there. We put the skull there. And then the instinct is I'm going to have what's left, which is called mala, that owns them. It's evident you won't get that. It's straight away very obvious. So where is Dan? I mean, this is just a cursory look at it. This is just a simple level. This has got to be done to profound degrees in very subtle meditation to truly get this realization, you know, the realization of emptiness. But there is no Dan. There is Dan. This is the point. So we tend to have the two wrong views now. We have the very fixed, solid, real view that kind of concretizes and internalizes Dan-ness as real from his own side. And this, in Buddhist terms, is the actual view of Christianity and the view of the Hindu view of like reifying, of saying an absolute real solid entity is there called soul or Atman. This is the argument, right, they discuss. So Buddhism would say you investigate that even further. You cannot find that. So then what happens is as soon as we start to investigate and think, well, where's the real Dan, then we come up with the view that there's nothing from its own side, it's empty. So then we go to the other extreme, these are the two extremes they say, and we chuck the baby out with the bathwater, oh, there's no Dan. So therefore it doesn't matter what happens, the cup must float or die, who cares, there is no Dan. That's nihilism. That's not true either. So these two views, maybe there aren't so many philosophical systems that are nihilistic. I mean, I think the existentialists are probably the closest one we can come to of late, isn't it, that has a nihilistic view of reality. Whereas all the other religious views in this universe, the Christian, all these other ones, they're the other views, they're the eternalistic views. And this is the one that Buddhism says, we instinctively carry these two views around. They're instinctive within us, and these are the functions of this maripa, this ignorance, this ego grasping, you know. And so what we have to do is investigate. Because what we're saying is we grasp at a real Dan, a real Rabin, a real Mala, a real this, which is how come we have any fears at all? How come? Fear, in fact, they say, is the very energy of Dan-ness, is the grasping at Dan, fear. Because it's, you know, like sitting quietly and he's not being disturbed. Everything's cool. We know that. There's no freaking out. But as soon as he's attacked or punched or nearly hit by the car or someone insults him, the I, just like a lion, rises up. I am not that. And it's like an absolute belief, isn't it? In the real I, somewhere, walking around with Dan's fist, with Dan's eyelashes, with Dan's anger. Isn't it? That's how it feels. So that's what they say you have to investigate. And the investigation is this intense struggle between the two extreme views in meditation. You continually just kind of go too far, realize there can't be any Dan. As soon as you hear, Dan does not exist, which is a valid Buddhist statement. But what we do is we go too far. Like I said, we chuck the baby out with the bathwater. That's too extreme. And then we start playing, then the dependent arising. Lama Tsongkhapa is one of dependent arising. It's the flip side of emptiness. So we can say, ultimately, there is no Dan. This is a valid statement. They say this, you know, we have to look into that. Then equally, in terms of conventional reality, there is a Dan. There is a Mala. There are realities. Things do exist. There is love. There is good. There is bad. There is up. There is down. But as soon as we posit it, we grasp at it too strongly. And as soon as we negate it and say there isn't one, we chuck it out too much. So these two extremes are what we have to end up through meditation, eventually getting what they call the middle way. Truly at the subtlest level, finding the literally the non-contradictoriness between these two statements, that there is a Dan and there is not a Dan. I mean, this just sounds like a bit cliche now, but these are said to be definitely true. And it's the discovery of the dependent arising of Dan that leads you to the emptiness of Dan. And they say when you really realize them, they help you each realize the other, right? Because they don't contradict. They're two sides of the same coin. This is the whole investigation of the wisdom side of Buddhist teaching. And this is finally the antidote to the maripa, to the root cause of suffering. When you've got this one through meditation, is when you have found bliss and when you have cut the root of suffering. And you cut the root of Dan in the gross sense, but you continue to exist. And now you will exist if you're practicing the bodhisattva path as well, the one of compassion. You will now exist as an amazingly blissful being who will have immense compassion for others and only want to benefit others, which will cause you to be reborn and reborn and reborn, but this time out of complete volition. This is how they say. So thank you for continuing your discussion. Is that helpful? Okay, good. Good. Okay, that's the main thing. More? Anything? Yes, please. Go on. Regret, yes. Absolutely, yes. Yes, yes. Guilt, neurotic guilt. Oh, I know. Okay, yes. That's it. Absolutely. Okay, very clear point, yeah. Absolutely. So look, putting it, again, philosophically, right? The reason we get, when we say, oh, I'm so sorry, I did that we have what we call guilt, which means we cling to, we say, I am bad. Right? That's what it's saying, isn't it? Well, that is because we have this wrong view of being a self-existent soul and real meanness. That as soon as we think I did something bad, I am so terrible. Because what happens with ego grasping, talking about the way we relate to ourselves, this maripa, we identify I by whatever we do. Now you check how we criticize other people. Guilt is just internalized anger. Now you check if I hate Stephen. He did that to me. Forevermore, if I'm really holding on to that, which we normally do, I whenever I think of him, it's on the basis of that one punch, nothing else in his life. I paint the whole of that person by that one tiny activity. You understand what I'm saying? So one of the real, this is the thing of these delusions, one of the other characteristics besides being deluded and by being disturbed, they exaggerate grossly the actual truth. The reality is, I regret having harmed you. But that harm was one action that I did at 2 o'clock yesterday. In between that time and before that time, I've been kind, I've been generous, I've tried to do my best, I've done many other good things. But the neurotic mind, as soon as I say, I did that, I paint the whole of me by that one activity. It's clearly unintelligent. But it's the function of the ego grasping. It's because we have ego grasping that we do that. We see everything as self-existent. So then as soon as someone praises you, we get all inflated. I'm so special. And then you deflate it. Oh, I'm so terrible. It's a load of rubbish, both of them. They're not true. You see my point? It's like you're looking in the mirror and you're saying, I'm so beautiful. Then you look in the mirror and you say, I'm so ugly. They're just both extreme and nonsense, childlike exaggerations. Do you see what I'm saying? That's the characteristic of all delusions, is they exaggerate everything. So my anger exaggerates his horribleness. Somebody else loves Stephen. They can see his kindness and compassion because I'm so petulant because he hurt me. All of Stephen is horrible. And so it's the same with myself. It's just pathetic. It's just internalized anger. It's equally as destructive as hating someone else. The added thing, no, it's not as bad as me hating Stephen because I'm harming him as well as me. Guilt just harms me. But it's just not true. It's a load of junk. That's the evolution of it. Do you see what I'm saying? So regret is an intelligent, wholesome ownership of the fact that you are a creep sometimes. Not you, but your creepiness. Your anger is horrible, you not. Do you understand? So it's owning that with great confidence, because you have the other part of you that you have identified with that is good, that gives you the courage to own your own faults without exaggerating them and identifying with them. And it's very wholesome and energetic and kind of interdependent, because it's, you're immediately thinking, I did that, what a fool I am. What can I do to remove it? Guilt just looks in the past, like the Dalai Lama said, and gets stuck in, oh, I'm so terrible, you know. And you just go down and down. It's self-obsessed. It's another way of being self-obsessed, like being beautiful, that's all. It's the same, coming from the same delusion. And it doesn't look at how you can change anything, because the point is, of ego grasping, we're stuck in who we think we are. Whatever the latest story is, you know. We're stuck in it. It's paralyzed. And that's the opposite of emptiness. But regret is interdependence. It's like thinking, and this is why this is a good analogy. It's a perfect analogy. Let's say you take poison, and you know, you discover that you've eaten that poison food, and it's going to kill you. Now, would you sit there and say, oh, I'm such a bad person, I took this poison, what am I going to do, I'm such a bad person? Excuse me, you're dying, for God's sake. You would be galvanized into action, wouldn't you? Who the hell can I go to? Who is going to give me medicine to get rid of this poison? You'd be frantic to do something about it. You wouldn't be guilty, for God's sake. You would think, what a fool I was, you know. And then you'd do something about it. Well, that's the four purification points. Regret, being the first one in this context, is recognizing, owning your garbage, but with great confidence, because you know it's not the real you. It's just part of you. And then it immediately leads you to the second one, which is, whom can I turn to get the medicine? To antidote, to be the antidote. And that's, in this context, Buddha. You go for refuge. And Buddha is like the doctor. He's not the person who cures you. It's not like God. It's, you're using his medicine, which is his methods. And that's what refuge is. With great relief, you found a person who's given you methods who can make you better. And then you put your money where your mouth is and you do the practice. And then you determine, with great courage, not to do it again, because you believe you can. It's very potent, the whole four steps, you see. Does that make sense? What's the problem? Okay. I was shouting, wasn't I? I just realized. Yep. Yes. Yes. A really good question. I know, it's kind of, it can almost be a bit depressing if we think this, because as a lion, you can see she virtually has no chance as a lion, because she's stuck in, talk about identifying with who she thinks she is. This is the absolute, I think, this is the way that ignorance or marigpa really manifests. She is just paralyzed in her sense of who she thinks she is, with not a fraction of a millimeter of possibility of change. But the point is, she, like us, has countless other imprints, also of virtue, sitting there waiting on her little mind stream that aren't ripening right now, all those other seeds. So at some point, this the karmic kind of gas tank of lion lives and all the stuff that goes will eventually run out, will weaken, and then some miracle, a little space will come one time, and that will be ripened by one action that she will do of virtue, spontaneously, towards her baby, say, in one life or other. And that virtue will ripen, and then, like a miracle, will create the cause for her to take another life again, and some of them, then the virtues can start to ripen again, because they're in her mind. But all those karmic imprints that she created as the lion will also be in her mind, which is why, while we're on this good wicket, as we say, if you're into cricket, you're on a good wicket, stick to it, they say. We're on a good wicket right now. We've got a good human life. We have choices, which is one of the miracles of a human mind. You take this opportunity now to do the one level of practice, which is this purification, pulling out the weeds before they grow. That's the whole idea. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Darling girl, it's like, you know, the whole deal. It's sort of a big whole holistic package. But one of the, if you're looking at precisely one of them, called attachment, then attachment, it depends on what level it's functioning. Let's say it's a simple level of like, just can't say no to the third piece of cake, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? And let's look at behind that, though. What's behind that? If we analyze all these delusions, there's this sense of kind of like, oh, I have to have it, isn't it? Almost as if without the cake you're just miserable. That's how it feels, isn't it? That's the energy of attachment, and that's one of the characteristics of attachment. It projects much more onto the cake than it really has got, because we have this sense of alienation and loneliness and neediness, and we're convinced cake will do it. So one simple antidote to attachment is, don't put your hand out. It's cold turkey. Now, that doesn't just mean going on a diet. We do this all the time. That's just training your body. But if you then, on the basis of controlling your body, you then start to look at the mind and taste the neediness and feel the yearning and feel the uncomfort and feel the pain of it and start to see how that is suffering. And this is very, very difficult to see. This is incredibly difficult to see, because we are addicted. We're junkies, basically, which is what we're attachment. Our attachment is basically being a junkie. At very much subtler levels than our gross level of what a junkie is, but it's the same one. And this is interesting, because it's in talking in terms now of the package of the three types of suffering. The second kind, they call it changeable suffering, which is much subtler, which is the recognition, when we do a lot of contemplating, that even what we call happiness now, meaning what we think the happiness is that we get from that cake, it's actually in the nature of suffering, the more you analyze it. Because you check, just like, and this is why I think this is a good analogy,
if you're not a junkie, let's say, and you look at a junkie and you see their whole deal, the whole deal of being a junkie to you is obviously the whole deal is being suffering. For a junkie, what's suffering? Is only having the craving for the junk, right? But the junk is called happiness. You understand what I'm saying? But if you're looking on, excuse me, the whole thing, you can see that when they're having the junk, all they're doing is sowing the seeds to have even more grasping, more suffering. Well, that's the second level of suffering. Recognizing that even what we call happiness now is actually like getting the fix. And why? Because it's based on the fantasy called attachment. And this is quite subtle. It needs a lot of looking at. Lama Yeshe, he said, I can tell you about attachment for one whole year. And you will never begin to see it until you start working deeply in your own mind through meditation and through observing the way this motor, this energy of attachment functions. Not just at the gross level with cakes, but every moment. It's like a motor propelling us to every single experience. This constant, oh, maybe it's there. That's where happiness is. Now it's the next thought, the next breath, the next cup of tea, the next person, the next job, you know. Isn't it? We can see. And it's terrifying to think of giving it up. And as Lama Zopa says, when you're told, sorry guys, you're only going to be happy when you give up attachment, we think, oh my God, I've got to give up my happiness? I've got to give up my heart? Because we think right now, because we've never looked into it, that what we've got is called happiness and the method is to get it, is the method is attachment. But Buddha's saying if you begin to puncture that and with much analysis, look at it, being your own therapist, as Lama Yeshe says, you'll really start to see. And then you'll start to be able to discriminate. This is the point, not chuck the baby out with the bathwater. We have to learn to discriminate between attachment and happiness, attachment and pleasure, attachment and love. And they are very, very different. Attachment is now what pollutes our love. Attachment is what pollutes our happiness. And we all know, actually, this is true, when you're not so grasping after that cake, you actually enjoy it more. And it's a simple experience we all have. When you're so frantic for something, you just make a mess. Do you see my point? We all know this, but we don't analyze it. We don't get the real conclusion from it. Because we're all junkies, you see. This is the major cause of suffering. You can see it. This is the second level of suffering they call the suffering of change. That everything changes. That what we call happiness leads inexorably to more suffering. We can see it. Because when you have the cake, it leads to being empty again and even craving it more. Go out to the sun, you know. Oh, so warm, so lovely. As soon as it gets too hot, you know, come inside. Oh, so cool, so lovely. As soon as it gets too cold, go out to the sun. Oh, it's so hot, so lovely. Excuse me, we do this until we die. And that's what we keep, that's how we, the only way we know to get happiness is this way. And it's all based on attachment. And so it's therefore polluted. Therefore it doesn't last. And all Buddha's saying is, nothing esoteric, nothing spiritual, nothing secret, nothing high, but honey, when you give up being a junkie, you will be in yourself happy. You will have found happiness. Happiness is what's left when you've given up the pollution. Happiness is what's left when you've given up attachment. So the method to find happiness is to give up attachment, not find something else. It's not an easy job. It's the hardest job in the world. It's the hardest job. The hardest job, because the third level of suffering, they call it all-pervasive suffering, which is even more subtle, which is that we are born into, due to past delusion, we are born into the body of a junkie. And we live in a universe of junk. The five sense object, which is what this basic universe is basically the junk for our five senses. So we are absolutely locked into being a junkie. So it's very hard to stop being a junkie when your very body and mind itself are the body and mind of a junkie. And the universe itself is the junk. It's the food for the five senses. So it's to go beyond it is not an easy job. But it's possible. Yeah, that's what Buddha says. We just have to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't trying to find spiritual enlightenment the ultimate attachment?
If you are attached to it, which means you see it as more than it is, which means you cling and grasp to it, which means you freak out if you don't get it, then excuse me, you're not. It's just a joke to call it. You wouldn't be practicing anyway. It wouldn't, therefore it wouldn't be a spiritual path though, that's the point. It's just a you're attached to a fantasy of a spiritual path. It wouldn't be a real spiritual path, because it couldn't be, because you wouldn't be getting what the result is. So yes, of course, it can be. But to want it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be attached to it. The symptom of attachment is when you don't get it, you freak out. Even mildly. So we all can see, so to have a big aspiration to want something is a marvelous thing. But it doesn't mean you're attached to it. Attached to it is you grasp at it, see it as more. That's one of the characteristics of exaggerating. But if you don't exaggerate it, and you work really hard to get it because you have the motivation to be beneficial to others, this is a sublime thing, you know. This is marvelous.
So we have to be able to discriminate between attachment and love, attachment and aspiration, attachment and joy. They're not the same thing. And that's hard to see as well. Attachment, again, there's various characteristics of these neurotic states of mind. They're deluded in the sense that they're just distorted in what they're seeing. They're not accurate. They exaggerate the object that you're grasping at, and the mind is very disturbed when you have them. So if that's not there, it's not attachment. If I say to you, would you like a cup of tea? Oh, I love that cup of tea, you say. And then I say, oh, sorry, there's only coffee. Oh, that's cool. That is a sign that was not attachment. Do you see my point? You can be blissfully wanting a cup of tea, but if the moment you don't get it, you can just drop it like a hot cake, that shows you were not attached. It just shows you had much enthusiasm. There's nothing wrong with that. It's marvelous. Which is why we often misinterpret these teachings. They end up becoming some kind of passive vegetable. Would you like a cup of tea? Oh, I don't care. Would you like a cup of coffee? Oh, I don't care. That's not detachment. That's indifference, and that's revolting. Do you see my point? So don't lose your enthusiasm and your joy and your aspiration, but just give up the neurosis, that's all, which is the I wanting to get what it wants. Being a control freak. Being a control freak is attachment, that's all. It's a nice, tasty way of saying it. It's important. It is crucial to distinguish between them. And that just, again, is only from internal investigation, really looking into our minds and meditating. I think it's time to go, isn't it? 12:30, 12:20? Finished? Time finished? So, okay. Maybe we just do a little prayer to finish. Like a little dedication. And this is, again, this prayer, so-called. It's your mind doing something. So just think, you know. Think. Each of us sitting here a couple of hours, you know. These, and as many moments as there have been in this 2 hours, is as many karmic seeds you have planted in your mind. So you're a very different person that's walked in 2 hours ago. Don't think you're the same person. This I that we grasp at, you know. You're a very different person. There's a whole new bunch of seeds planted in your mind. New imprints, new propensities. So from this bit of gardening we've all done, you know. May we nourish these seeds with our future virtue from this moment. Kindness, clarity, joy. And may we offer them. Just to have a thought now of offering the fruits of these seeds, which is necessarily, you know, much happiness and clarity and joy and all that, to all beings, every living being, imagine them all, receiving the benefit of these seeds that we have planted. And we just sing a little prayer that, join in, if you know it, that says this in Tibetan. Something like that, anyway. Gewa ji nyu du da Lama Sangye Drup Gyur Ne Drowa Chi Khyang Ma Lu Pang Deyi Sala Gopa Shok Jang Chob Sen Chok Rin Po Che Ma Khe Pa Nam Khe Gyo Chik Khe Pa Nyam Pa Me Pa Yang Gong Ne Gong Du Pa Va Okay. Thank you, everybody, very much.